Welcome to Level Up, inspirational and informative podcast listening for legal professionals and legal enthusiasts throughout the Caribbean, and a production of Caribbean Barrister, a legal marketplace and networking platform for legal professionals. Power up and get connected with each episode of the Level Up.
Welcome to Level Up, a legal podcast. I'm your host, Faith Hall, a 2001 graduate of the University of Buckingham, England, and a longtime writer. Find out more about me at beingfaith.com.
Caribbean Barrister is pleased to have as its maiden interviewee, Attorney Alfred Sayers, QC, Managing Partner of Sayers & Co. The Bahamas. Mr. Sayers is licensed to practice law in New York, New Jersey, and the District of Columbia, as well as Jamaica and the Bahamas. He has had an illustrious career as lecturer, practicing attorney, contributing writer to several law journals, chairman of the Caribbean Action Financial Task Force, attorney general of the Bahamas, minister of education in the Bahamas, chairman of the Council of the College of the Bahamas, and member of parliament for Fort Charlotte, New Providence. Most recently, he has released his memoirs and has been an advocate for the gaming industry in the Bahamas. Welcome to our first podcast.
Well, Ms. Hall, it's a pleasure to be on this inaugural presentation or conversation.
Today we are focusing on the gaming industry of the Bahamas. Since the sliding tax scale of up to 50% levied on that industry in the current administration's 2018-2019 budget communication. But before we explore that, can you tell us of your knowledge of the history of gaming in the Bahamas, and more specifically gaming among locals, from an historical illegal enterprise to the 2014 legislation which sought to regulate the industry?
Okay, well, as you know, before gaming has always really been a part of the popular life in the Bahamas. I mean, the churches, the Catholic churches, Anglican churches have raffles and other games. So it's been a part of the civic life, and within the popular society, we have had gaming, which was known locally as numbers, and this is similar to many parts of the Caribbean, where you have wagering, which is unregulated. In the Bahamas, prior to the 1960s, we had limited gaming for the seasonal visitors, and they were restricted to one or two private clubs in Nassau, where you had a limited form of gaming. In the late 50s, early 1960s, the government at the time, which was still under the colonial control, and a government that was dominated by the local white merchant elite of our country, who were colloquially known as the Bay Street Boys. In the late 50s and early 60s, there was a systematic transformation of the Bahamian economy, and it had a very direct impact on organized gambling. The government at that time, with the colonial administration, moved to change the economy from a seasonal tourist economy with agriculture and fisheries to what we call a year-round tourist industry. So there was a regime developed to build, first of all, to build hotels and amenities to attract larger numbers of tourists. And part of this plan was to have organized gambling as an amenity to the hotel incentives that were being that were legislated to attract foreign direct investment to fuel this development. And of course, along with that, they also under the chairman of the development board at that time, Sir Sartre Sands, a very aggressive policy to attract banks and other financial institutions, along with developers of hotels and resorts. So what we had was the Hotel Encouragement Act, which was the major piece of legislation to facilitate this. And through the Development Board, which later morphed into the Ministry of Tourism, in around 1963, you had a very significant development. And the government in Stafford Sands, as the primary representative of the Executive Council, began a plan, or facilitated a plan, by Wallace Groves, who was the developer of Freeport, and a guy by the name of Chesler. And through the Grand Bahama Port Authority and the amusement, the Grand Bahama Amusement Company, and also the Grand Bahama Development Company, they approached the government with along with a number of casino interests. And as you know, many of the casino interests who were alleged to have, some of whom, not all, ties with organized criminal organizations and known persons, had been in Cuba. And after the Cuban Revolution, they were looking for another base within the Caribbean to locate their gaming interests. So in 1963, the government licensed for the first time casinos in the Bahamas. And the Grand Bahama Amusement Company, with Chesler and Wallace Groves, they were the persons behind it, along with a lot of interests, persons who are well known in the U.S. and in who had been involved in Cuba. And many of these interests were financing the casino operation in the Bahamas. What is interesting about this is that, as you know, during this period, you had the mobilization for majority rule by the Progressive Liberal Party. And one of the campaign issues was this issue of corruption, and corruption tied to the gambling interests that had just been approved in 1963. And in the general election of 1967, this became a pivotal issue in the campaign. And the UDP government at that time, it had become so controversial after there were a number of revelations relating to gaining interest in the Bahamas and political and corruption, in The Economist, in the Wall Street Journal, and in a number of other national publications in the UK as well as in the US. And the UBP, in their cabinet, they agreed to establish a commission of inquiry, but they decided to do it after the election. But unfortunately for them, unfortunately for the Progressive Liberal Party, they did not have that opportunity. And one of the first things that the PLD did upon assuming office in January 1967 was to establish a commission of inquiry to investigate gaming, casino gambling, and the allegations of corruption. The commission was appointed under an English jurist by the name of Bacon, and this commission was able to make a number of findings. One, they found that the casino interests that had been given the license had basically given monetary contribution to just about to most of the people who had made the decision. For example, the commission established that Sir Roland Simonet, who was on the Executive Council and who later became, after 1963, the first premier of the Bahamas, he got a consultancy contract for which, you know, it was a very handsome, and we're talking in 1963, we're talking in the area of ten thousand, in some instances 20,000. So Stafford Sands, who was the lawyer for the interests and also a member of the Executive Council and the chairman of the Development Board, that was leading this initiative in terms of attracting investors to the Bahamas, Dr. Sawyer, Bobby Simonet, who was the Speaker of the House, F.W. Brown, also another member of the Executive Council. Also, other prominent people in the Bahamas had been given under the guise of consultancy contracts. You had, for example, the editor of the Tribune, Sir Eddie LePuig. Also, his brother, Eugene LePuig, who was a QC, I think was given 10,000. So Eddie and 20,000. So what you had was the unearthing of all of these persons who had made the decision or had influenced the making of the decision to grant the casino license that had been granted in 1963. They all had received contributions. In addition, the UBP had also received, was getting on a monthly basis, $10,000 as a political contribution. So their party and the leading personalities. What was interesting, Sir Roland, before the Commission of Inquiry, had stated that he was personally, for religious reasons, opposed to gambling. But nevertheless, it was discovered that he had accepted a consultancy contract, and there were many other building contract. He was a road builder and also constructing marinas in Grand Bahama and so on. So what we saw then is that organized gambling came into the Bahamas, casino gambling, that is, under very controversial circumstances. But what is interesting is that from then to now, the concessions which the Stafford Sands designed have been part of the casino infrastructure from then, which was 1963, right to this day, which is 2018, under the budget of the Ministry of Tourism, we subsidize the casinos in the Bahamas every year from inception. Atlantis receives $5 million, approximately $5 million. Bahama now receives a similar amount under the rubric of promotional contribution. But the major amenities of the largest resorts in the Bahamas is the casino. And they each, that is the hotel enterprise in which they are located, receive cash contribution in addition to exemption from the taxes such as custom duty, VAT, and in some instances even stamp duty for their operation. So that is the context in which the casinos came into the Bahamas, and they are still from then to now a major attraction of the major resorts within the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. In terms of the folk gambling, that is the popular gambling among the local Bahamian persons, it's been for the most part unregulated. You have had a practice by churches and fairs and civic organizations applying for an occasional license to have raffles like the Red Cross and other organizations where gaming has been a regular feature of the fundraising activity for these religious and civic organizations. The popular practice of numbers, what was called playing the numbers, has essentially been unregulated and been subject from time to time to criminal prosecution, to raids, and so on. But it's been few and far between. It's really been an unregulated activity. And pretty rudimentary, that is, a physical practice of throwing a ball, and you had bookies taking bets in the neighborhood on a piece of paper and so on. So it's really been a very informal, historically, a very informal practice until about 20, 15 years ago, we saw this practice among the Bahamian popular gaming. And let me say that when the casinos were introduced to the Bahamas, Bahamian citizens and permanent residents were prohibited from participating. So from the outset, we have a gaming entertainment activity that is subsidized by the state, that is licensed by the state, and that receives very, very significant exemptions from taxes by the state, but the citizens of the country, since inception, have not been allowed. And when the Bahamas became independent in 1973, in the independence constitution, provision was made to continue this practice and to immunize it from attack on the ground of discrimination. So in the constitution of our country, of the Bahamas, in Article 26, one of the exemptions that you will find is that the government can legitimately exclude citizens and residents from participating in the casino. So that's really been the history of gaming in terms of the casino and also the game of numbers. One, that is the casinos for foreign, for tourists primarily, has been subsidized, exempt, highly regulated by the gaming board to ensure integrity and of the games and the proper conduct. And on the other hand, the popular gaming activity of numbers that the citizens and permanent residents who are here working or persons who are guests but not tourists will participate in an unregulated activity of gaming activities, which have historically been very reliable but not regulated by the state.
Okay, I want to raise the issue of race and class, but you've addressed it vaguely. But I want to fast forward to a gaming industry, a local gaming industry that could no longer be ignored, about 10 years, and then the journey to having to face to regulate that industry and the difference in how that underground gaming industry, controlled mainly by Black Bahamians in this country, was treated differently than, as you explained, the historical development of casino gambling in this country. So if you could speak briefly about the social perception of the development of that underground numbers industry that had to be regulated in 2014.
Yeah, I'm happy you raised the issue of race and class, because in the development of the tourism, the mass-based tourism infrastructure in the Bahamas, it was done within the colonial context. It was done in an environment in the Bahamas at that time where you had segregation, where Black Bahamians were often required to transact their businesses through the back door of businesses on Bay Street, in banks, were denied employment as tellers and clerical workers. And you had really, even in the hotels, such as the British Colonial Hotel, in the 50s, and you had even Black African-American tourists were denied admission and had to seek accommodation over the hill at some of the guest houses and hotels run by Black Bahamians, such as the Reinhardt Hotel and other guest houses around in Grantstown and Bain Town. So what you have then is the prohibition of the local population from the casinos was, I believe, framed by the race and or the race the racial prejudice as well as the class exclusion that existed at that time. And I think it's relevant to the question that you raise, which is the numbers industry, which is the local gaming, was essentially left controlled by Black Bahamians, very just an occasional notice by the state. You'll have a raid here, a raid there from time to time, and very seldom would you have a conviction because the legal architecture was not, there was no careful attention to regulate it, and even with respect to criminal sanctions, there was seldom any amendments and so on to deal with this evolving industry. In as younger entrepreneurs entered that field, one of the things that changed was rather than it being a very informal activity that was very manual, what you had were a number of Black entrepreneurs who came and they brought technology and applied technology to the industry. And very rapidly, we see, for example, within the past 15 years to 10 years, the industry becoming very sophisticated, where you have mobile devices as opposed to the bookie with a piece of paper. You have the use of computers, and you have essentially what was a manual exercise in terms of the conduct of the games and the organization of the business. What you increasingly had was a virtual infrastructure where rather than throwing a physical ball, there was reference to lotteries, regulated lotteries like the Florida Lottery, and secondary betting on activities which were observable. People could see it on TV. You could verify it and so on like that. And as even more younger people got into the industry, you have the introduction of casino games online. And the subscription of the offering of subscription where one could participate in the games without going into the physical premises or having any contact with a bookie or an agent. And this developed very, very rapidly. And I would say today that the most sophisticated enterprises in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas in terms of the application of technology would be in the gaming houses. You have a group of young entrepreneurs who engage in the global gaming industry and are in high demand in other jurisdictions because people have looked at the gaming houses, housing industry in the Bahamas and seen the innovation. Many of the entrepreneurs, not only are they operators, but many of them have a full complement of developers. In other words, they own they have ownership of the intellectual property of the games. They are creating games. They have persons who are exclusively dedicated to them, preparing computer programs and so on, creating new platforms. So increasingly then, this industry came under more scrutiny because as it grew, the impact on the economy was significant in terms of employment, in terms of the lease and rental of premises. Also, you had the reinvestment of profits being generated in other areas such as real estate development. And as you have this quantum leap in terms of growth, in terms of revenue generation, employment, the impact on the public revenue, because even though the industry was not regulated, the government collected national insurance with respect to the employees. The government collected business license because the operators of the gaming houses, they had web shop licenses or web cafe licenses. So the government itself was also the beneficiary. And as increasingly the industry came to the attention of the International Monetary Fund, as they carried out their annual Article 4 review of the Bahamian economy, it came under the scrutiny of the FATF in terms of that given the scale and slope of the resources, that if not regulated, it could represent a money laundering threat. So increasingly then, the government came under external pressure to regulate the industry. And therefore, in this would have been under the Ingram administration, the government, this would have been around 2010, the prime minister and minister of finance instructed Mr. Ehud Cunningham to open up a formal discussion with the industry. And Mr. Cunningham at that time, I think, was financial secretary or acting financial secretary of the country. So you had, for the first time, a formal dialogue established between the industry and the government of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. And in those discussions, the government became more intimately aware because the operators disclose as a condition of non-prosecution, and with the hope that the industry would finally get the kind of respect as other sectors of the society, and that it would be fully regulated, because many of the operators appreciated that if it were not regulated, given its size and it's a very cash intensive industry, there were certain dangers and risk, because if you were robbed and it's difficult to go and report it. So there was a clear recognition that in the interest of the industry, there needed to be a regulated environment. You also had difficulty banking and having access to the normal facilities of commerce. So in 2010, the operators disclosed to the government their financial affairs, and what you had then was the beginning of a conversation towards regularization. In 2012, there was a change of government, and the Progressive Liberal Party won that general election. And you had a process that had been started under the previous government. And the question was, what should be done in terms of there was certainly a legitimate expectation on the part of the industry, because they had already fully disclosed their proprietary affairs, and it was done on the understanding that there would be some process of regularization. The new government, it seems, I was not a part of that government. I mean, I was not in the cabinet, and I was not in parliament. I didn't run in 2012. I decided to return to the private sector. But I served as chairman of the College of the Bahamas to carry it to university status. The government made a decision. First of all, let me just state from my own point of view, it was clear, it was in the national interest, that an industry that was generating such a significant amount of money and employing such a significant number of persons, and with all of the multiplier effect it was having on the society, needed to be regularize, especially in a society where gambling was already legal. And you had the white operators, the white foreign operators of the casinos, with all of the safeguards and plus being subsidized. And you had a gaming sector of in which the local, primarily Black Bahamians participated in, that was unregulated, that was in a quasi zone in terms of legality, because the definition of illegal gambling was a very physical definition. It involved premises and so on. And by that time, the gaming was in cyberspace. So the legal architecture in terms of criminal prosecution was very difficult. And you had these Bahamian entrepreneurs with major, major undertakings and employees and so on. And they couldn't bank their money. The government clearly appreciated that it had an obligation in terms of the international obligation, in terms of anti-money laundering. But these were Bahamians doing exactly what foreign investors are allowed to do, but didn't have the proper safeguards of carrying out a proper enterprise. And the irony is the government was making money from it. So the government under Mr. Christie, Prime Minister Christie at that time, decided they amended the law. And I guess they were looking for political cover because they didn't want to offend the church. Now the church, ironically, they go to Atlantis all the time.
Right.
And they have conventions in Atlantis, and some of them walk through the casino to get to where they're going. And no, the churches, as far as I'm aware, as an organized body, has not really challenge gambling that we subsidize. But of course, you had a strong opposition by some churches. I mean, the Catholic Church, Archbishop Burke issued a very, what I thought, thoughtful statement that gaming per se is not a sin, but that it is the abuse.
Yes, the addiction.
It is the accept the addiction, yes. That is the problem. So the government, the Christie administration, my view is that there was a recognition that this needed to be regularized. But I think there was a view that it was so widespread, or so many behaviors participated in it, why not let's put it out to a vote and the government will not get any flack?
Right.
Because the popular opinion will be to regularize it.
Yeah.
And in 2012, the government put forward in December 2012 an amendment, and this amendment is called the Constitutional Referendum Act Amendment. And they amended the Constitutional Referendum Act to enable the government to carry out another. A referendum is normally to amend the Constitution. So what they did was they amended this act so that the government could conduct a referendum, but not to amend the Constitution. And in the amendment, I just read one paragraph. It says, "Where the minister considers it desirable that the views of the electorate of the Bahamas be obtained on any matter of national importance other than a matter to which Section 2(1), that is, constitutional amendment, applies, he may advise the Governor General to issue an order directing that a referendum other than a constitutional referendum be held for that purpose." So what the government did by this amendment is that it provided a mechanism to have a referendum on the issue of whether there should be a national lottery and whether the web shops should be legalized, so to speak, or regulated. And the expectation, and I think this was a political miscalculation, the expectation was that it would have come back favorable, and therefore the government would have cover to do what I believe was in the national interest to do. But the government wanted to have a poll saying, well, it ain't me. it's what the behavior people want, right? But it was a miscalculation because first and foremost, in the Bahamas, the definition of referendum is taken very seriously. People see it as having a determinative effect. Because we've had a referendum on the issue of equality. By that time, we had one. Subsequent, we've had another. And in every instance, it's really whether to change the constitution. But in this particular referendum, it was really a polling exercise.
Right.
But that was not sufficiently understood and appreciated, I don't think, by the Bahamian people. And you had a major mobilization by the church, by some elements within the church, a more fundamentalist element, calling for Bahamians to say no to gambling. And even people I know, some persons who participate in numbers and voted no. Also, you had the opposition. You know, referendum in the Bahamas tend to be used by the party opposite. And the party opposite had a good reason. Because the party opposite, previous to this referendum, had sponsored a referendum. And the PLP, which was in opposition at that time, mobilized against that referendum on the basis that the process was bad.
Yes.
So this was really an opportunity for political payback. Certainly, you had a very effective mobilization by certain church organizations against it. So the referendum was negative, and the government, nevertheless, notwithstanding the poll in 2014, they'll continue the consultations that had been started by the Ingram administration, and those consultations eventually led to the passage in 2014 of a number of legislation regulating the domestic gaming. And you also had the amendment of the Financial Transaction Reporting Act, which made gaming houses not only regulated, but also defined them as financial institutions. Okay. So they are treated like banks, trust companies, lawyers, who are engaged in representing people buying and selling land, as accountants who so we see then that the same KYC and and due diligence obligations and compliance obligations of other financial institutions were applied to the gaming houses, as they're called now under the Gaming Act and the Gaming House regulations.
I want to fast forward before we run out of time to the meat of the subject, and that is this summer, the government raised taxes all around, but they introduced a sliding tax scale on the backs of the local gaming industry. What are your thoughts on that, and how legally sound do you think the decision was?
Well, in the budget of this year, on the 30th of May, the government, in its budget communication, unveiled some very significant taxes. The current tax at that time on gaming houses was 11%. And the gaming houses are involved in an area of gaming called interactive gaming. And if you were to look at, so it's 11%, and then you have 2% that's also assessed for charitable purposes. Now, if you look at interactive gaming, the rate of tax in Belgium is 11%, in Denmark 20, in Florida 25, in Gibraltar 1%, Italy 20, Malta 5. One of the highest is, of course, France, which is 46. New Jersey is 17.5%. South Africa, 6%. Spain, 25%. Sweden, 18%. And in the UK, it's 15%. And what the government did in this budget is that it increased the tax rate on interactive gaming by the web houses or gaming houses to 20 at the lowest end of the scale, up to 50% at the higher end. In other words, if you make up to 20 million, some operators that could be taxed up to 50% of what is known as GGR, which is the gross gaming revenue. If you, I personally believe, but first of all, let me disclose. My firm, Sears & Co., we are the lawyers for one of the gaming operators, and that's Playtech, which is popularly known as Island Luck. And Island Luck is the market leader in this industry within the Bahamas. So I just want to make that disclosure. Increase, I believe, is currently being challenged. We are currently in the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas on judicial review on another aspect that I've not mentioned. In addition to being taxed up to 50%, the government also imposed a 5% stamp tax on all deposits made by anybody. If you deposit $100 with a gaming house, you have to, the gaming house operator is mandated to take out 5% of that $100 and put it aside for the government. This is before you decide to wager on anything. You've just put a deposit down. So in addition to being taxed on regaining revenue, the government has also imposed a 5% stamp tax. Now, when you look at the casinos, for example, there is no deposit tax on any deposit made with respect to its interactive gaming or any aspect of its gaming. Its rate of tax generally is about 5%. And you have a scale, but the scale goes really from its inverse to the scale that is being applied to the gaming houses. Then, when you look, for example, at other similarly situated industries or enterprises in the Bahamas, if you look, for example, at Commonwealth Bury, the Minister of Gaming, he said, well, the reason we did this because this is a sin tax. but if you look, the biggest producer in the Bahamas of alcohol is Commonwealth Bury. They produce the lick. I think they also deal with cigarette and a number of other
alcoholic pleasures.
Right, alcohol pleasures, right? And tobacco pleasures. But if you look at the rate of tax for Commonwealth Bury, it's 12% in excise duties and taxes. If you look at financial institutions, for example, Commonwealth Bank, its rate of tax is 6%. And if no one says, well, or look at how much they take home, because the net income in with some of these is over $50 million. But no one is saying that, well, as a financial institution like gaming house operators, your rate of tax should increase up to 50%. So first, this was done without any meaningful consultation, because had there been consultation, there would have been I think a better appreciation that what the government has done in this instance is inconsistent with the global practice. And what the data has demonstrated is that when you increase tax, and there are a number of studies, one of which we have shared after the fact with the government, because we didn't know that this sliding scale was even being contemplated. One of the studies called the Oxford study that was done, I think, for Denmark, what they demonstrated is that when a rate of tax exceeds 20%, or GGR, the tendency within the market is more and more players will move into the unregulated market, because the cost of gaming in the unregulated market is cheaper and you get a better return. So this is called channelization. What we see in the Bahamas is that we are running the risk of driving players into the unregulated market, which will, again, right back to where we started,
yes,
it will have an implication for anti-money laundering and expose the Bahamas to possible sanctions on the basis of these money laundering threats. It is also I in my view, it is definitely discriminatory.
Okay.
But I think in addition to being discriminatory, and I certainly appreciate the challenges given the way our Constitution is framed, but I think that notwithstanding the exception in Article 26, a claim can also be made that this variation, not imposition, but this variation in the tax rate is unconstitutional. It is also unconstitutional, I believe, on a different ground, and that is it represents confiscatory taking.
Yes.
In other words, it's a form of expropriation. Because what the government, as they have explained it, they've looked at other jurisdictions where you may have a monopoly or where the government owns the gaming enterprise and hires an operator. They have used those examples and they say in those places, the government gets 70% and the operator gets 30%. That's consistent with a monopoly, or that's consistent where the state owns the enterprise. What they're seeking to do here is to, in this increase, is give the state 70% of the net income, and the owner of the enterprise, the person who would have taken all of the risk, the person who would have come up with the innovation, the person who actually, under law, has the beneficial interests, will become an employer of the state. And that is why I say, and based on the cases that I have looked at, if the primary motive of the tax is regulation or punishment, then a tax measure, and there are many cases in the United States where the primary motive is not revenue raising, but the primary motive, you know, you look at a group of young black behaviors and the view is they don't deserve to have it.
Right.
You know, I mean, so but no one is looking at the bank. No one is looking at a brewery. No one is looking at any other institution and as a tax process, how do we apply in a proportional manner? Because the law requires that when you exercise the power of the state, there be, you act rationally, that there be proportionality, that there not be bias. And certainly from some of the statements that have been made by representatives of the government, there appears to be bias, there appears to be irrational syntax. You choose with sin. Shouldn't, and the other thing which I found disturbing, and having served in the cabinet, is you cannot, in carrying out a national policy for the peace, order, and good government of the Bahamas, you cannot have a major ship without empirical study.
Yes.
There has to be empirical study. You need to have the benefit. And I commend the Christie administration for this because they went out and they got the best technical advice they could. They brought in consultants because the fact that you are elected in parliament and the prime minister appoints you to the cabinet doesn't make you an expert. The duty is to inform oneself so that one can make the best policy for the peace, order, and good government of the Commonwealth.
Yes.
And I am shocked that there was not the kind of empirical study to inform the choice that was made. And we are in court, and in due course, in discovery, we will be able to see on what basis which experts inform this choice. So in addition to the judicial review, certainly my client will be making a number of claims, constitutional claims, due process claims, and other claims. And the court will decide.
Oh, this is an exciting time.
It certainly is.
When do we look forward to the case being heard?
Well, the judicial review on the stamp tax is currently before the Supreme Court, Her Ladyship, Madam Justice Charles. And we have been conversations with the Attorney General. It's been adjourned to enable the industry to have consultations, and those consultations are underway. And on the other issues, the constitutional issues, we will come to those in due course.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Sears, for your time and for making us more aware of the history of gaming and the current journey of for equality and justice for an industry led in the main by ordinary Black Bahamians.
So that's a wrap on this episode of Level Up. We thank our guests, sponsors, and of course our listening audience. Join us next time for another current and lively conversation on the law. To find out how you can be a guest or supporting member, please email us at info@caribbeanbarrister.com. That's Level Up, the legal podcast.
Thanks for listening to Level Up, a production of Caribbean Barrister. Join one of our hosts for the next podcast, bringing you the latest in the life of law. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by Caribbean Barrister, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, sponsors, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.